First thing that happened is the judge is so amazed by this little tiny girl, and he asks her, "What are you here for?" And she just replies, "I'm here because I want to get divorced."
Meet a child bride in Yemen who took on a deep-seated tradition and won. And after the genocide, Rwanda made a stunning recovery. But a human rights expert says things aren't looking so rosy right now. Plus, in South Africa, an orchestra project that's defied all expectations.
My name is Anisir. I'm 10 years old this year. My favorite pieces are Bach and Chikile Maweni and Pachabe.
Around the World with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymire. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. There's promising news out of the International AIDS Conference that just wrapped up in Vienna. The report that created the most excitement was about a new gel that women can use to protect themselves against HIV. A study showed that if a woman uses the gel regularly, she can cut her risk of infection by 54%. Women make up the majority of new AIDS cases in Africa, but many of those women often don't even know they have the disease. That's certainly the case in Kenya, where 2/3 of the population has never been tested. Now, people who are too embarrassed to go for a test during normal hours can go to a moonlight testing center and meet with health workers under cover of darkness. Reporter Wairimu Gitahi went to one of these centers in eastern Kenya, and she filed this story.
A van drives through the streets of Tala, announcing the opening of a moonlight testing center here in this small town. The announcer is encouraging people to get tested for HIV. Outside the 5 tents that make up this moonlight center, there's a constant hum of a generator that powers the lights. The centers are usually not permanent, but instead operate for a couple of days in one area and then move on. The centers are known as VCTs. That's short for Voluntary Counseling and Testing Centers. This one is run by a privately funded organization which works to stop the spread of HIV. Annette Kaore is the organization's VCT coordinator for Eastern Africa.
We give an opportunity to people who may not be able to access the services during the day, mainly due to the nature of their work. We also offer these services for people who are not comfortable to walk into a VCT center in broad daylight.
It's estimated that almost 8% of Kenya's adult population are infected with HIV. But 4 out of every 5 of them don't know it. And the vast majority of Kenyans never get tested for reasons such as taboos surrounding HIV and AIDS. So testing centers like this one play an important role. On this night, several young men and women stand outside the center trying to decide if they should get tested. 26-year-old James Chalo is one of them.
Why did you come here in the night? Why didn't you come during the day?
You know, I just came across this tents, got curious. So it's very confidential. So it's nice.
At last, Chalo makes up his mind to go in, and he has allowed me to witness the process.
Welcome, Chalo. Thank you. My name's Catherine. And I'll be your counselor for the next 20 minutes.
Each testing session is conducted privately between one client and a counselor in a small white tent. If they wish, clients can be accompanied. Catherine sits Chalo down at a plastic chair and begins the process.
Right now I'm removing the test kit from the container. Yeah. And I'm now pricking Chalo's finger. I'm drawing the blood using a capillary tube.
The counselor puts just a couple of drops of blood onto the test kit, and after a few seconds, she has the results. She tells Chalo that he's HIV negative, much to his relief.
Wow. Wow. Thank you, Lord. I was afraid to be turned positive. I'm thankful. Yeah.
For those who do test positive, counselors advise them on where to get follow-up counseling and on the importance of taking antiretroviral drugs, which are free in Kenya. However, after observing for a few hours, it's obvious that many people getting tested here tonight are drunk and might not be able to fully understand the testing and cancelling process. Annette Kagore says they used to refuse to test anyone who seemed intoxicated, but then they realized it was a lost opportunity.
So what we do now, we do not send away drunk clients, because sometimes reeking alcohol may not mean that that person is not able to make informed decisions. So the counselor gets to assess that. And if this person is too drunk, then they are referred to come another time when they are sober.
This Moonlight Testing Center has been up and running for 2 days. And now it's time to pack up and move on to the next town. For the World Vision Report, I'm Wairimu Gitahi in Tala, Eastern Kenya.
In the last few years, Rwanda has been a poster child for stability and good governance in Africa. The country made a remarkable recovery after the 1994 genocide that left 800,000 dead. Everyone from President Clinton to the CEO of Starbucks has praised Rwanda's President Paul Kagame for his work turning the country around. But in the run-up to next month's election in Rwanda, there have been some disturbing reports of repression and several murders. Some are pointing fingers at Kagame and his party, the Rwanda Patriotic Front, or RPF. Timothy Longman is head of the African Studies Center at Boston University. He lived in Rwanda for many years and is considered an expert on human rights there. He says what's happening right now concerns him.
There have been attacks in particular on opposition politicians and on journalists. There have been assassinations, there have been assassination attempts, there have been a number of arrests. The situation is really quite troubling for anyone who believes in democracy and democratic values.
Yeah, this is pretty surprising because most of the news we hear out of Rwanda, at least in this country, is very positive about how much progress they're making and how democratic Kagame really is.
Well, I mean, it's interesting for those of us who've been looking at the situation for a long time. It's part of a consistent pattern, really. There have been attacks in the past. Former Interior Minister Senda Shonga was assassinated in 1998, for example. There were a number of people who were pushed out of power in 2000. The former president was arrested. And so those things have happened in the past. It's just that right now there are a lot of things that are happening, and they seem to contrast with a lot of good press that Rwanda has gotten.
Kagame has a lot of support from his people. So I'm wondering what kind of reaction he's getting to all of these disappearances and so-called robberies and assassination attempts. I mean, the investigation I know is still ongoing. There isn't any hard evidence yet that these attacks have come from the Kagame regime. So what are people saying in Rwanda?
It depends who you talk to. There's a core of people that support Kagame very strongly, primarily people who've come back to Rwanda since 1994, people who, for the most part, lived outside of Rwanda almost all of their lives or were born in Uganda often. They're the core of support for Kagame. When you talk to them, few of them will actually deny that there are human rights abuses. People will say, yeah, you know, there are these bad things that have happened, but you have to understand that there was a genocide, and we have to rule with a strict hand in order to prevent genocide from happening again. If you talk to a common people and you're in a situation where they feel free to talk to you, they will tell you a very different story. I've been working in Rwanda for almost 20 years, and I know a lot of people very well. I know a lot of people who live in the countryside, who live on the hills. Someone emailed me a couple of weeks ago saying, I'm coming to the internet cafe very early in the morning so there's no one here so that they can't monitor what I'm writing. He said, but I want to tell you that we wake up in the morning with fear in our stomachs. He said, every day we expect new things to happen. There seems to be great fear in the part of a lot of the population. For most people, they just want to keep their heads down. They struggle daily to survive, and they don't really care that much about politics. And therefore, they want to get by, so they're not going to speak up and complain. They know what they're supposed to say. They know that they're supposed to say that everything is fine. So when reporters go out into the countryside, that's often what they hear. But anyone who raises their head, anyone who speaks about the inequality in the country, anyone who complains about the lack of freedom of speech, anyone who complains that that the civil society organizations are controlled by the government, any of those people find themselves arrested. They find themselves accused of genocide and thrown in jail, or they find themselves accused of promoting division in the country and they're thrown in jail, or in some cases they're assassinated. In many cases, they have to flee the country.
What is the Kagame administration saying in response to these accusations?
They have a couple of responses. First is to deny the accusations outright. And in most cases, that's what happens sort of at first, is to say, no, we had no involvement in it. When, in fact, evidence emerges that the RPF was behind an attack, then the regime talks about, well, justifications for what they're doing. And the common justification is to refer back to the genocide and that they have to do everything in their power to prevent that from happening again. And so when it's shown that, in fact, people were, in fact, attacked by the government, and in some cases we're not talking about assassinations, we're talking about arrests of people. So a number of journalists have been arrested, for example. They're accused, basically, of stirring up conditions that could cause genocide again. That sounds like a reasonable claim. You can understand why a government would want to prevent something like this from happening again. And yet, in fact, what's happened is any criticism of the regime gets equated with encouraging genocide. So that if you speak out about inequality, if you speak out about the human rights violations of the regime, the government calls that supporting genocide.
President Kagame is expected to win the upcoming election, hands down. What do you attribute this support to?
Well, very clever politics. And the fact that the regime has done some good things. Let me say that I'm not a complete critic of the RPF. Kagame has done some really amazing things, and his regime has. They're on women's rights, they've been amazing. They're in the forefront, not just of Africa, but of the world, in fact, in promoting women's rights. They've done a great job of managing development. They've done a good job of emphasizing education. And I think Kagame himself imagines Singapore to be his model. He thinks that if you push development enough and you make people's lives better, that in fact is going to mean that all the politics don't matter. But that isn't all, because what's happened is that most of the opposition parties that want to run against Kagame are not allowed to register and their candidates are not allowed to run. And so the fact that the groups that could present real opposition can't even register their parties and can't run candidates means that you don't have a real election going on. It's certainly not a free and fair election.
So who is holding Kagame responsible or accountable? Which human rights groups are watching the situation?
Well, unfortunately, there aren't any human rights groups on the ground or none that can operate. Human Rights Watch was recently kicked out of the country, and all of the local human rights groups, which used to be very vibrant, were crushed by the Kagame regime. There are a lot of people who are looking there. They aren't necessarily parts of formal human rights organizations, but they're are reports that are coming out that are quite reliable from Human Rights Watch and from Amnesty International, the International Crisis Group, Reporters Without Borders, the Committee to Protect Journalists. These are all groups that have been talking about the very troubling situation in Rwanda. There are also some international governments that have begun to become critical of Rwanda. The Swedes, for example, the Netherlands have begun to become more critical of the situation in Rwanda than they were before.
Timothy Longman is director of the African Studies Center at Boston University and an expert on human rights in Rwanda. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Coming up a little later in the show, we have a special segment on Yemen, where it is, who lives there, and why it's in the headlines. Stay with us for that. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. High-level officials from more than 40 countries met in Kabul a few days ago to discuss Afghanistan's future. For many Afghans, though, it's the past they're dealing with, especially the 1990s when the Taliban ruled. One of the legacies of that time is that many Afghans never got an education. Today, a whole generation of young people is trying to catch up. And it's not easy starting school when you're in your 20s. Reporter Will Everett met a young man who got some help from an unexpected source. Will filed this reporter's notebook.
His name was Abdullah, but I called him Smiley because, well, the 20-year-old had an irrepressible smile. That was surprising given the circumstances of his life. He's a member of the Hazara, an ethnic minority hated by the Taliban. When he was a child, his parents were both killed during the Civil War, forcing him to go to work at an early age. When I first met him in Bamyan, he was carrying wood and washing dishes, doing anything he could to survive. He'd never set foot inside a classroom and could neither read nor write. Flash forward 2 years. I was in Kabul and a mutual friend said, "Did you know Smiley's in town?" We went to see him one afternoon at his tiny apartment. We shook hands, and he treated me to that same infectious smile that I remembered, but now he was wearing reading glasses, and on his desk was a textbook open to a page of basic arithmetic. Turns out he'd been in Kabul for a year, participating in a government-sponsored accelerated learning program. He was hoping to get his high school diploma in about 2 years. I asked him how he made ends meet. He said his relatives gave him a little money for food, and his rent was completely free. That, he explained, was because of none other than the Afghan vice president, Karim Khalili. Khalili also arranged free rent for the other young men living in this government-owned building, all participating in the same school program. But why would the vice president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai's right-hand man, take a personal interest in these kids? Smiley said, "Why don't you ask him for yourself?" He made some phone calls, and a few days later I was invited to the presidential palace to meet Karim Khalili. Next thing I knew, I was inside Afghanistan's equivalent of the White House and strolling the red-carpeted floors toward the vice president's office. I asked him why he helps underprivileged young people, like my friend Smiley. It's really not that big of a deal, he said. So many young people come to Kabul to complete their education and have nowhere to live. They sleep in sheds like cattle. If we have some extra office space, what better way to use it? He knew what it was like for these guys. He had to drop out of college when the Soviets invaded in 1979. Then came the Civil War and the Taliban. When he went into politics, he never lost the urge to finish his education. He thought of young men like Smiley as his adopted sons, though most of them he didn't even know by name. Khalili had to cut the meeting short. He was headed out of town that afternoon. 3 days later, a suicide bomber detonated himself near the presidential palace. It left a crater in the street and was close enough that it blew out a few of the second-floor windows. Khalili was on the TV news that night, far away from the destruction. He was in the city of Mazar-i-Sharif, inaugurating a new school.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter and producer based in Texas. All eyes have been focused on South Africa this summer because of the World Cup soccer tournament. Today, we want to take you beyond the imposing stadiums to a shanty town on a steep hillside in Cape Town overlooking the ocean. That's where soccer balls have given way to string instruments. It all started when a local music teacher began to volunteer her time there. Now, children who had never seen a violin before are performing at everything from weddings to state functions. Reporter Sue Valentine sent us this audio postcard of the Hout Bay Music Project.
My name is Hisetu. I'm 11 years old and I play violin. I love to play violin and I love the project.
My name is Anisir. I'm 10 years old this year. My favorite pieces are Bach and Chikile Maweni and Pachabel.
My name is Leanne Dolman and I started the Hout Bay Music Project in the middle of 2003. It was something I was going to do in my spare time. I thought I would teach a group of 4 or 5 children from Oranje Kloof Primary School. I know there are no extramural activities. They don't even have a blade of grass at this school. So a friend of mine and I, we went and demonstrated what a piano and a violin sound like together, the kinds of music they can play, how you play the instruments. The whole school was there in the burning sun in the playground, standing. And after the performance, I happily announced that I would be teaching children who were interested. And I'll never forget that moment. There were about 800 children that put their hands in the air and shouted, "Teacher, please choose me." So I was like, oh dear.
My name is Mfundo Manana. I'm 16 years old. I'm in grade 10 at Kingsbury High School. And I play the double bass. I love the different strings and the sounds it makes.
They know the technique before they play pieces. The children know how to do a staccato, an upper staccato, downbow staccato, legato, whatever. Picking up some Bach or something is not a problem because they have all those techniques at their disposal. It's just a case of playing the notes. Some of the really surprising moments in this project have been seeing the children fascinated with black and white, crackly old films that people have managed to put onto YouTube, and fascinated with the different styles of playing, comparing Milstein to Oistrakh to Tsigeti, and we can talk about technique, and so they talk about how they like this one's vibrato and this one's staccato, and then imitating the players and saying, now I'm playing like this one or that one.
My name is Lwazi Mkula and I'm 16 years old. At first, your fingers, like when you finish, they hurt very much. You see, like, your knuckles, yeah, they like turn red like when it's your first time, yeah.
The piece is called Pachelbel's Canon by a composer, Johann Pachelbel.
At the moment, we're trying to get children into better schools. They're often in schools where the circumstances are not great, there's violence and great overcrowding. So we try to get them into better schools, find sponsorship for that, and once they've finished school, encourage them to study further, and not necessarily music. If they would like to study law or accounting or something like that, we're going to try and help them. We'd like them to come back and teach at the project and maybe receive some kind of remuneration for that and use that money while they're studying for whatever student expenses they have.
Best thing is that you meet new people, you learn new languages, because music is written in like Italian, you see. Now you learn a little bit of Italian, yeah, and you travel a lot. But hey, the worst thing is the long hours of practicing. Yeah, but it pays off at last, yeah. It pays off.
That story was produced by Sue Valentine, a freelance reporter in Cape Town, South Africa. Those aspiring musicians have good role models in the Soweto String Quartet. As you'd guess from their name, the four musicians come from Soweto, South Africa. That's the township best known for its struggle against apartheid. The musicians all learned to play string instruments as children. At first, people criticized them for playing European instruments instead of African ones. But the musicians won their critics over when they began to fuse classical music with township jazz and African harmonies. The quartet even performed at the inauguration of President Nelson Mandela. Over the years, the Soweto String Quartet has developed a distinctive sound. Here they are playing Zebra Crossing. Thank you. That was the Soweto String Quartet playing Zebra Crossing. And now we're turning our focus to the Middle East, to the country of Yemen. Seems we're hearing about this tiny Arab country all over the place these days.
Is Yemen the new front in the war on terror?
New threats being posed by Yemen.
The story also
even on Comedy
Yemen
Central's Colbert Report.
Yemen.
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 Now, some out there say Yemenis are not our enemies, but I bet they can't say that three times fast. So it's time for the first installment of my unlimited part series, Better Know an Enemy. Tonight, Yemen, the fightin'.
We thought this might be a good time to take a closer look at Yemen and to bring you a couple of stories from there. But before we do that, here's a quick primer for some background. Yemen is an ancient country, and it's said to have been home to the Queen of Sheba. It's about the size of France, with a population of 23 million, 99% of whom are Muslim. Yemen sits at the southernmost tip of the Arabian Peninsula, just south of Saudi Arabia, and just across the sea from Ethiopia. It's a deeply traditional and tribal society, and the poorest country in the Middle East. Women there have little power. Just 30% of them can read, compared to 70% of the men. The country is up against serious challenges. The biggest might be Al-Qaeda. A branch of the terrorist group is active in Yemen, and several recent terrorist attacks, like the Christmas Day bomb plot and the shootings at Fort Hood, have all been linked to the Yemen group. Another critical issue facing Yemen is their dwindling resources. They're reported to be running out of oil, their main export, and the water is drying up. In fact, the capital, Sana'a, is predicted to be the first city in the world to run out of water sometime in the next 10 years. Now we take you inside Yemen to the offices of the Yemen Times. That's an English-language newspaper published by Yemen's first woman newspaper editor-in-chief. She's trying to help her developing country overcome some of the challenges it faces. Dale Gavlak reports from Sana'a.
Hello? Yes, it's right,
but now it's 1 hour. Nadia Sakaf stands out in a regal purple dress as she juggles keyboard and phone. Most other Yemeni women are shrouded in black cloaks, the required garb in public places. The 32-year-old has a boldness and boundless energy that contrasts with her petite frame. Al-Sakaf is the editor-in-chief of Yemen's first English-language newspaper, which her father founded 20 years ago.
What we first need to understand about Yemen Times is that it's an independent newspaper. And it has a mission to make Yemen a good world citizen. And by this we mean that when you hear or read about Yemen, you don't think automatically of Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, but you think about historic, beautiful Yemen, you think about development, you think about education, you think about very nice things that we hope our country one day will be.
Al-Sakaf received a master's degree in information technology in Britain and took over the Yemen Times helm some 7 years ago from her brother. This chief editor, despite being a wife and mother, is a top-level professional in a place where women are still a minority in the job market.
There is a stereotype here in Yemen that tells female journalists that you should go write about family and cooking and fashion. What are you doing here talking about economy?
Her independent paper covers news and runs special reports on Yemen's economy, culture, and entertainment. The paper also covers human rights and gender issues, something other papers, most of which are government-controlled, shy away from. Al-Sakaf has written editorials on these subjects and has even penned one dealing with religion, a potentially explosive piece for this religiously conservative country. She reads from it here.
Yemenis revert to God in most of their doings and what happens to them. You make an appointment with someone and he or she says Inshallah, which means God willing, and does not show up. Apparently this Inshallah was supposed to do the trick, and if God had wanted the meeting to take place, he would have sent angels to drag the person and take him and her to the appointment on time. Not necessary.
There's lively banter as Al-Sakaf holds an impromptu meeting with her reporters to talk about the paper's next issue.
The problem is that you have to do a lot of follow-up.
Today, an undercover investigation into police corruption is being finalized. Al-Sakaf says the paper pushes the envelope by publishing a lot of strong, critical stories. Yet press freedom has a long way to go in Yemen.
When I talk to journalists and editors from developed countries, they say, well, look, we've struggled for this. We fought for 200 years or so to get this. And the problem is that I cannot afford to wait another 200 years.
Al-Sakaf says she is happy the paper generates reader feedback, which is all part of the public discussion of important issues.
If you go to the website, you will find the comments from the readers. Some of them disagree, some of them like it, and it's a free country, I think.
I head to the coffee trader, Yemen's homegrown answer to Starbucks, to get some first-hand reader reaction. Yemeni microfinance specialist Adil, who declined to give his last name, says the Yemen Times is quite informative.
It reports some of the realities in Yemen, you know, and of course within the limits, you know, of the freedom of speech, you know, in this country. So I think it makes a positive contribution.
An American named Vincent, who also declined to give his last name, teaches English in Sana'a. He says he sometimes reads the Yemen Times.
It seems like one big editorial sometimes. A lot of opinions masked as factual information. I don't have a lot of patience for that, so I, you know, when I see that, when I come across it, I just put it down.
It seems that even among Yemen Times readers, Nadia Al-Sakaf courts controversy. But she probably wouldn't have it any other way. For the World Vision Report, I'm Del Gavlak in Sana'a, Yemen.
Coming up, the story of another Yemeni pioneer, but this one's only 10 years old.
I'm a simple village girl whose family had to move to the capital, and I've always obeyed the orders of my father and brothers. Since forever, I have learned to say yes to everything. Today, I have decided to say no.
Stay with us in Yemen on the World Vision Report. Welcome back to the World Vision Report and to our special focus on Yemen. Nadia Al-Sakaf is the editor of the English-language Yemen Times, as you just heard before the break. A few years ago, her paper published a report of a little girl, a child bride, who had successfully divorced her husband. The girl was just 10 years old. Delphine Minoui is a French-Iranian reporter who helped that little girl write a book about her ordeal. We'll talk with Delphine Minoui in a moment. But first, here's a reading from the book titled I Am Najoud, Age 10, and Divorced. In this scene, the girl has just arrived all on her own at the imposing courthouse in the city.
On the white walls, like the ones in a hospital, I can see writing in Arabic. But no matter how I try, I can't manage to read the inscriptions. I was forced to leave school during my second year, right before my life became a nightmare. And aside from my first name, Najoud, I can't write much, which really embarrasses me. Looking around, I spy a group of men in olive-green uniforms. They must be policemen, or else soldiers. One of them has a rifle slung over his shoulder. I'm shaking. If they see me, they might arrest me. A little girl running away from home? That just isn't done. Trembling, I latch on to the first passing veil, hoping to get the attention of the unknown woman it conceals. A tiny voice inside me whispers, "Go on, Najoud. It's true you're only a girl, but you're also a woman. And a real one, even though you're still having trouble accepting that. I want to talk to the judge. Two big eyes, framed in black, stare at me in surprise. The lady in front of me hadn't seen me approach her. What? I want to talk to the judge. Which judge are you looking for? I just want to speak to a judge, that's all. But there are lots of judges in this courthouse. Take me to a judge, it doesn't matter which one. She stares at me in silence, astonished by my determination. Unless it's my shrill little cry that has frozen her solid. I'm a simple village girl whose family had to move to the capital, and I've always obeyed the orders of my father and brothers. Since forever, I have learned to say yes to everything. Today, I have decided to say no.
That was Megan Johnston reading from the book I Am Najoud, Age 10, and Divorced. It was written by French-Iranian journalist Delphine Minoui, who covers the Middle East for Le Figaro, and who's here to tell us the story. Thanks so much for joining us and being on the show today.
Thank you.
Delphine, you helped this 10-year-old child bride in Yemen get her story out. Her name is Najoud. How did you first learn about her?
The first time I heard about her was when she started filing for a divorce. It was in April 2008. And there was a little article mentioning her story in the Yemen Times. And that's how I heard about her. And I was so touched by her story that I decided to tell her story in an article for my newspaper, Le Figaro.
So you met this little girl. What were your first impressions of her?
When you see Najoud, she looks like a little girl. You know, she's very small. She's very tiny. You talk with her and she talks about playing hide and seek and watching TV and liking eating chocolate. But on the other hand, when you start asking her about the story, the tragedy she went through, her face changes completely. And she starts telling about her own experience. The fact of being married when she was only 10 years old to a man who was three times her age. And I was so impressed by how brave she was to try to fight against this marriage and to escape to a court to get a divorce.
How does a child like Najoud end up as a bride at the age of 10?
You know, actually, sadly, this is a very common tradition in Yemen. Girls are married when they are very young. Actually, according to a survey that was conducted a few years ago, half of the girls under the age of 18 are married to men who are usually older than them. There are different reasons. First of all, of course, Yemen is an Islamic country. And when you walk in the streets, you see all the women being covered. Women don't have much access to jobs or to education. But there are many other reasons. Among them, you know, Yemen is full of tribal tradition. And so when you go to the provinces, the tribes have more power than any other political system. And according to the tribal tradition, there is this issue of honor, which is very important. So for them, for the fathers, they are scared to keep their girls without being married because they are afraid that they would go out with men. And of course, according to the tribal tradition, having a relationship with someone of the other sex before being married is kind of a taboo.
Yes, but 9 or 10, do these parents really think that it's physically safe and emotionally okay for a little girl that age to be married to a man three times her age?
Well, that's a big problem indeed, because those girls are not at all ready for being married. They don't know what marriage means. But you know, another problem which the parents are facing is the poverty. Yemen is a very, very poor country. And if you take the example of Najoud herself, her dad is unemployed. He has two wives, 16 kids. When I was talking to him, when I was researching for doing some research for the book, and I was asking him, how could you even consider marrying your little girl so early? He said, look, I don't have enough money. I cannot feed all my family. I need to send my kids to beg in the streets to be able to buy some food at night. So for him, marrying Najoud was somehow a way of, you know, getting rid of part of his burdens on his shoulders. And that was one of the main reasons as well.
You mentioned that it's partly because it's the tribal custom, but also partly the religion. What about Islam would say that it's okay for young girls as young as 9 and 10 to be married? Is there something in the Quran about this?
Yes, you know, they refer to the Prophet Muhammad, who himself married one of his wives, Aisha, when she was only 9 years old. And for them, it's one of the reasons why it's very important for them to keep on encouraging girls like Najoud to get married very young. Actually, Nojoud broke out a taboo. And when I was in Sana'a, I could even hear some people saying that she should be killed for what she did because she behaved against the principles of Islam, according to some very conservative and traditionalist people.
You say that half of the girls in Yemen are married before they're 18. How unusual is it for a girl to be married as young as 9 or 10?
You know, when you get out of the capital of Yemen, when you go out of Sana'a, you see a lot of girls, actually, aged like 12 years old, 13 years old, carrying babies in their arms. So which means they are not only married, but they are already mothers. And this is something very common, especially in the north of Yemen, which is, more conservative than the south.
So many, many young girls are caught in a situation like Nojoud, but her story is very unusual in that she actually got a divorce at 10, which raised quite a stir in Yemen. How did this little girl manage to divorce her husband?
You know, it happened in a very strange way, which shows how brave this little girl is. She was, after she got married, the husband brought her back to the little village he was from, and he locked her up. She was prevented from leaving the house. She was prevented from going to school. And he started forcing her to have sexual relationship with him at night. And she really suffered from him. After a while, she kept on complaining. She kept on crying, but nobody wanted to listen to her. Until that day when the husband said, "Okay, I'm going to bring you back to your parents in Sana'a, the capital, and you'll stay there for a few days, but then you have to promise me we'll go back to the village." They go back to Sana'a, and she starts talking to her parents. She starts telling them about her story, and no one wants to listen to her. The father says, "You know, you're married, you have to stay with your husband." The mother says, "Look, Nojoud, that's part of our destiny. Us as Yemeni women, we cannot do anything." And one day, out of despair, she decides to go and visit the second wife of her father. And the second wife tells Nojoud, "Listen, Nojoud, if you want to find a solution, the only way is to go to the court." And Nojoud, of course, I mean, she's a little girl. She doesn't really know what a court is. So what happens is the next day, when her mom asks her to go and buy some bread, she gives her some money. Nojoud goes out of the house, and instead of going to the bakery, she just takes a taxi on her own, and she ends up in the court. She makes her way through the office of one of the judges, and first thing that happens is the judge is so amazed by this little tiny girl, and he asks her, "What are you here for?" And she just replies, "I'm here because I want to get divorced." And that's how it all starts.
So she went to the court on her own to get a divorce. And obviously, this went through the court system, and she was granted a divorce, which is very unusual. What kind of reaction was there in Yemen to this?
Well, actually, there were two different reactions. On the one hand, women activists were so happy. For them, it was a big victory. And for them, Nojoud was some kind of role model that they would use as an example to show that women's rights can improve on a daily basis. But on the other hand, Nojoud had to face a lot of pressure from some Islamists, as well as people from her own family, including cousins and brothers, who were telling her that she was violating the honor of the family. And, you know, in Yemen, like in other Middle East countries, honor is a big issue. And you sometimes can reach this issue of honor killing. So that was something that was scary especially for Nojoud and for her sisters, who were afraid of seeing the ex-husband taking some sort of revenge against Nojoud.
Yeah, would it have been his family taking revenge with honor killings?
You know what happened at the end is that the husband totally disappeared and the family never heard about him anymore. And somehow the international attention and the fact that Nojoud's story was spread out everywhere, not only in Yemen, but also in neighboring countries like Saudi, these international attention kind of protected her, and it will actually guarantee her safety in the future.
Where is she living now? I mean, are her parents protecting her now? I mean, she's only how old today?
Now, Nujood is 12 years old, and she is back to her family. She lives with her parents. But luckily, you know, after we worked on that book together to tell her story, we decided to give all the royalties to Nujood. So thanks to the royalties, it's paying for her school. She's back to school now with her little sister, Haifa. We also managed to buy a brand new house for the family, which is now close to the school. The problem was that the dad and the brother were still unemployed. So we found a house, and on the basement, on the ground floor of the house, there is a grocery shop where the brothers and the dad are now working.
It sounds like this family is doing pretty well now.
The family is doing pretty well. And you know, what is very interesting as well is like to see how Nujood's story inspired other girls. Since Nujood got divorced, she inspired at least three other girls who managed to get divorced. So she became like a, you know, like a symbol, like a model in terms of fighting for women's rights. And also her example was used by some female activists to push inside the parliament for a new law, for a new reform, in order to increase the age of marriage from 15 to 17. And this is now a law that has been under debate inside the parliament in Sana'a.
Even if that law goes through, will it make much difference unless there's stronger enforcement?
Well, that's the question that is raised indeed. But what women activists are saying is that it's a long-term process. And if you see it from a Yemeni point of view, to them it's much better than nothing. And what was really hard for them along those last years before Nujood's case, they were always blamed to be anti-Islamic, as well as being pro-West. And with Nujood's example, like Nujood is a little girl, she didn't know what the West means. I mean, she was living, you know, in her own environment. So to these women activists, it's a good example of how the fight, the struggle, come deeply from deep inside the society, from a poor girl who had no education, who didn't know how to read, how to write. And still, she decided to fight for herself. And for the first time in her life, she decided to say no to what was imposed to her.
I understand that even though you've finished the book with her, you are still in touch with Nujood very frequently. And I'm wondering just how she's doing.
I talk with her at least once a week. We talk by phone. I call her. So she's back to school. She's also seeing someone who is helping her in terms of her psychology. So she starts feeling better step by step. And as a good example of how she kind of is back to a normal life, you know, Nujood always loved drawing. One of my friends recently was in Yemen, and she brought me back a beautiful drawing made by Nujood. She actually drew her new house, which looks full of color, with a lot of kids and with a lot of toys. And it's definitely a good image about how Nujood is back to her childhood because she is still a little girl.
Delphine Minuit is author of the book I Am Nujood, Age 10 and Divorced. We spoke to her from her offices in Beirut. Delphine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
An international summer festival gets underway this month in Sana'a. It includes famous authors, poets, puppet shows, and plenty of music. Here's just a sample of what people will be listening to. That's music by Fuad Al-Kibzi from Yemen. And that's where we leave you today. Remember, you can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. And did you know you could receive a weekly email from us with links to all our new stories? Simply provide your email address on our homepage at worldvisionreport.org. The show is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization. والمعلى راسي كتحملات.